I'm sorry, what name did you say?
Would you lead us in a prayer?
Oh, okay. I just thought I heard my name. All right. Let's pray. O Lord our God, you are the eternal one. You are the King of all the ages. You have always guided your people, and you guide them to this day. And we are thankful that we have become a part of this kingdom, which is unlike any other kingdom, because it has a king unlike any other king. Thank you for your faithfulness, your greatness, your power, and your love. And help us to follow faithfully. Help us to learn from the past. Help us to resist all the different schemes of Satan. Help us to be aware of them after our lesson tonight and be equipped by your word to fight back. Thank you also for all of our loved ones who are here with us, who share the same desire. Please bless each one, especially help those with the body who are suffering in any way. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you very much. Isn't this church blessed with good people that move in? We just have so much to be thankful for, and we're glad to have Brigham and Esther and their children here, along with others that have moved in fairly recently. Well, we get back to our study of church history. I hope you're finding it useful. It has been beneficial to me to renew my thoughts on the subject as I've studied various books in preparation for these lessons. Of necessity, we have to go very quickly over some very important and valuable information, but maybe just getting the outline of history will be helpful for us. And the greatest use is to learn from what mistakes have been made in the past and what good things have been done so that we can avoid the mistakes and repeat the good things in our own time. Lesson 4 was set in what is commonly called the Dark Ages. I say commonly. There's been a lot of debate about that lately, and some insist there were not any Dark Ages. But some describe it as a period of time when the intellectual activities practically stood still, along with other areas of history. Things just weren't happening much. These years contributed little to the growth of intellectual life. In fact, education was not common, and many who came into power were people who were illiterate. The hordes that moved into Rome and destroyed the Roman Empire, many of them couldn't read or write. But it was a period of great superstition and stereotyped beliefs. It's all been described also as a time of, darkness because of corruption within the Catholic Church. Even the Catholics must agree that there was considerable corruption, such as popes that were ruling as kings, the veneration of saints and relics, and which is so superstitious, and a licentious priesthood who were not pure in their lives at all. And there was institutionalized moral hypocrisy. Those are not my words, but they're the words of a historian. There were groups opposing Rome, and I'll not go through that list again. We mentioned them with a little note last week. We're not suggesting that these were New Testament churches. They were, however, persecuted seriously. An Inquisition court was set up in which they were actually tried and thousands actually put to death. We'll mention that a little bit later in tonight's lesson, simply because they were not in harmony with the teaching and the worship and work of the popes. Most of what we know about these groups is from their enemies. And even when enemies desire to give an accurate description of their enemies, they find it difficult to do so. They give the worst impressions of those that they consider enemies. And so we don't really know exactly what some of these groups believed and practiced. They varied in their teaching, and it's probable that most of them were quite wrong in some things. But the fact is that they were trying to get back to the original Christianity and recognize that the Catholic Church was not the original church, and they saw the faults in it and wanted to correct those faults, but the church was not willing to be corrected. And so they were eliminated by one way or another, excommunicated, or in many, many instances, put to death. Most of them rejected the names by which they were called, and I think we can understand that. There was a prominent preacher among us named Alexander Campbell a couple of centuries ago, and we were called Campbellites by many people around us. But that was not our choice of a name. We never wanted that name. And the evidence is that the Albigenses and Paulicans and the Waldensians did not want to be called that, but in many instances simply wanted to be called Christians. But you can't always help what your enemies call you. And it's in this case, it's the enemies that write the books and write the history. And so you're labeled as your enemies want to label you. Now, at the same time that we don't know what they believe because what we hear is by their enemies, there is considerable evidence that the Catholics are given undeserved credit for some good things that happened. And that's understandable if a historian considers the Catholic Church the same as the original church. Then whatever happened, even in the original church, is credited to the Catholic Church. And one example of that is that Pope Gregory sent Augustine to evangelize England in 595. That's when the Pope really began to exercise authority in England. But Patrick is said to have Christianized Ireland in 432, which is 160 years earlier than when Gregory sent Augustine to England. And so what was he doing? Of course, the Catholic Church makes him into a Catholic, but the evidence is that he was not a Catholic, and rather that he practiced baptism for remission of sins and baptism of believers by immersion. Keith Sisman has done a great deal of investigation of this subject, and I have a book that he wrote called The Traces of the Kingdom, and he says that the Celtic Church that Patrick evangelized for, and who never called themselves the Celtic Church, would be taken over and forced into submission to Rome over many decades. Most of what we know of Patrick was written a long time after his death, and it reflects later Roman Catholic inventions, fabulous fables, miracles, and myths that were not necessarily practiced by Patrick at all. And so Sisman insists that really the churches that Patrick created and are established by his preaching in Ireland were originally churches that we would consider churches of Christ. That's a hard matter to decide, but it was not the Roman Catholic Church. That's the point that's being made. A historian generally called the Venerable Bede places Christianity in England in 167, which was long before the Catholic Church really began. And Gildas, an older historian, previous historian, claims that 61 AD was the date when Christianity came to England. And it, somewhat in support of that is what we have in Colossians, the first chapter, verses 6 and 23, where Paul says that the gospel had been preached in all the world. He says that twice to every creature. Meaning, of course, I think the world of the Romans, But England was a part of the Roman Empire at this time. And if he says it was preached in all the world, then that would have included England. And this historian, Gildas, that we've mentioned, claims 61 A.D. is the date when Christianity came, and that would be about the time the Apostle Paul was writing the book of Colossians. But following, and I apologize for doing so much talking, but that's about the only way we can cover a lot of this material. This period, generally known as the Dark Ages, was followed by what's called the Renaissance. And that's a word that means an awakening or a new birth. Pardon me. And there's a good bit of debate about the dates of this period. I think most historians acknowledge that there was a change that took place from what were called the Dark Ages, but just when it began and what event actually inaugurated it is a question that this historians debate, and as also just when it ended and another period began. But generally you can say it was the 1300s and 1400s, and perhaps reaching over into the 1500s, that this period occurred. It brought new learning. Universities began to multiply, and more young students came into the universities and learned the languages that were taught there, Greek, Latin, even Hebrew. It was the time when the printing press was found and was invented, which made possible the spreading of ideas for reading, which had not been possible before. It was a time of increased travel, when people were going from one country to another, especially in Europe. And it was a time of individualism, in which individuals became important, and their views were considered significant, and they were considered capable of thinking for themselves without having to be led by great scholars such as the Catholic Church produced. And I'm going to add one more to that. There was a development of nationalism that had considerable influence in the Restoration or Reformation period, which we'll study in just a few moments. This just meant that the rulers of the various nations, such as England and Germany, had come to resent the influence of the Pope among them, and so they were a little bit more willing to reject his leadership and the influence that flowed out of Italy, and especially the money that was flowing into Italy. They resented that. They wanted to keep it in their own territory. And there were three basic principles that grew out of this period. One was that the priesthood of all believers was a reality, that each individual had some responsibility and ability to come to God without having to go through the church. Also, the all-sufficiency of the scriptures, and we'll see how that developed. And then the idea of salvation by faith. And that's something we believe. We have discussed faith only so much that sometimes the idea of just being saved by faith escapes us, but that's the basis of salvation as described by the writer of the book of Romans particularly. It's an active faith. It's not an inactive faith, as some teach, but it is the basis of our salvation, faith. Trusting God rather than trusting ourselves. John Wycliffe has been called the morning star of the Reformation. Born in 1320, he lived to 64 years to 1384. He was educated at Oxford, and he became a professor there, was recognized as a most eminent scholar, highly regarded in Oxford. I recall visiting Oxford University and seeing where he taught. He wrote that the popes might err, that popes were not necessary, and that worldly popes should be removed. Well, you can just imagine the pope didn't take to that very well. But he was defended by some of the prominent leaders in England, partly on the basis of that nationalism that I mentioned a minute ago. They were resentful of the influence of the pope and of Italy in their affairs, and they regretted that so much of their income was going to Rome rather than staying in England. And so John of Gaunt particularly was a defender of John Wycliffe, who's spoken of as the morning star of the Reformation. English nationalism was saved him, as we've noted, and he insisted that the scriptures are the supreme authority and that laymen could understand them. And based on that, he translated the scriptures into English. In fact, his was the first translation, as I understand it, into the common language of the people. Up to this point, it had been primarily in Latin, but also, of course, in Greek. But the church was very, Catholic Church, very eager that only small portions should be circulated among the people. And there are numerous quotations to the effect that it would be extremely dangerous to let the scriptures get into the hands of common people, all kinds of evils. One writer just listed all kinds of evils that would come from it if the people had access to the scriptures. But one of the major ideas and projects of John Wycliffe was to translate the scriptures and put them into the hands of the people, of the common people. His followers were called Lollards by their enemies, but they called themselves Christians, and there is ample evidence they called themselves Churches of Christ. Now, I want to just say a word about the term Church of Christ. It's a scriptural name for local groups, along with Churches of God, Church of the Firstborn. It's a good name, but any group of people that can wear it that want to. So the mere fact that a group is called a Church of Christ does not make them a Church of Christ. But on the other hand, if they are a Church of Christ, they ought not to be unwilling to be called that, but along with it, Church of God, Church of the Firstborn, anything that the scriptures actually use as descriptions of the church. It's not a proper name. It's simply a description of the people who meet together under the authority of Jesus Christ. But the Lollards circulated the Bibles and went about teaching and influencing people all through England. And we're going to see that the influence of Wycliffe's teaching reached far beyond England, even into Bohemia and Eastern Europe. And that brings us to another leader, John Huss of Prague. He's called John the Baptist of the Reformation, born 1373 and living till 1415. And if you go to Prague today, there is a huge statue right in a very prominent place of John Huss. He was a very popular professor and preacher in Prague, and apparently thousands came to hear him preach. He greatly was influenced by Wycliffe, but he influenced many, many people in the area of Prague and Hungary and in the Balkans. They called themselves brother or sister. This is a quotation from that time, incidentally. They had no authority than scriptures. They opposed infant baptism. They taught believers baptism by dipping, and they elected officers from the laity, which is an interesting departure, of course, from Roman Catholic practice. There's an interesting letter from John Huss to a church in London, And his last words were, the Church of Christ in Bohemia greets the Church of Christ in England. Again, I'm not saying that means it was the New Testament church, but they had that much of it right anyway, and we rejoice in that. He was called to the Council of Constance to be tried as for heresy, and he was promised safe passage. In other words, the official who was in position to do so promised that if he would come, he could then return safely and would not be executed. But at the Council of Constance, he was condemned. And they argued that once a man is excommunicated and condemned, he has no rights at all. And so he had no reason to be protected. So they burned him at the stake, and that was the end of Hus, but it was not the end of his influence. And incidentally, the same council that ordered Hus to be burned at the stake ordered the bones of Wycliffe over in England to be exhumed, dug up out of the grave, burned, and his ashes thrown in the river. This was a time when opposition to the Pope was likely to bring death if it was successful enough to bring one's case to the ears of the Pope and those responsible. And that brings us to Martin Luther. Now, we're here to something earlier. Hus died in 1415. But Martin Luther was born in 1483, so we're moving ahead. It's interesting to me that neither Wycliffe nor Hus were said to be successful, but in my judgment, they were successful in that in their generation, they established churches that were apparently close to New Testament teaching. They didn't leave behind any kind of a denomination, but what more does it require to be successful than to establish churches on the New Testament order in one's own lifetime? It's said that David served his generation, and that's all we can serve. What the apostles did was to establish local churches. They later apostatized. They didn't leave behind a denomination, but these men were largely successful, just as the apostles had been, though we don't, of course, judge whether the churches they established were New Testament churches. The Lord only has to judge those things. I think about those seven churches of Asia, and I would have given first honors to the church in Ephesus, I think, from what is said, but that's the one the Lord threatened with removing the candlestick. On the other hand, some others I would have thought would have not been faithful churches at all, but the Lord didn't reject them because there were some that had not defiled their garments. But looking at Martin Luther, of course, a very, very influential man, and in spite of the fact that he made some mistakes and failed to go as far as he should have, he was a great man. Many, many years ago, there was a movie made concerning his life, and I made considerable effort to get to a church that was showing it, and I was greatly influenced by it. Martin Luther was a great man in many, many ways. He was born very poor. His father was a miner, but he was very eager for Luther's education, and so without any funds, he sent Luther off to the university. And Luther had to beg and to sing and to fast, that is, give up food for much longer than most of us would want to, just because he didn't have any way to buy it. He had to do everything necessary to get his education, but he got one and was highly qualified in the scholarly pursuit. After he had gained his degree, his father wanted him to be a lawyer, but he chose theology over his father's desire that he study law. And he became a monk. He entered into a monastery. And he observed that if one could be saved by monkery, he would be sure to go to heaven. But he was concerned about his sins and realized that he was a sinner. And that's something that all of us need to realize, because we experience sin, and the scriptures confirm the fact that we're all sinners. And he could not see the way out for his forgiveness. He punished himself in various ways. If you read his life closely, you can find that he did many things just to be uncomfortable, and the thought that suffering, physical suffering in some way or other, could relieve his conscience and make him feel that his sins were forgiven. But
you need to put the nuggets on the plate.
What's that?
Sorry, I didn't realize I wasn't on mute.
That's all right. No problem.
Okay. I got some babies.
All right. All right. He was, he punished himself seeking forgiveness, but he felt that he was not gaining forgiveness. The monastery sent him to Rome, and he thought, this is a wonderful privilege. At last, he hoped that he might become satisfied of his forgiveness if he could just visit those holy places in Rome. But he was disappointed at the moral corruption that he found there. Even among the priests, they were making jokes in Latin when they were supposed to be speaking in the Mass, what we would call the Lord's Supper. And there were other signs of their immorality. And he was very turned off by it. And he was disappointed that the various works that he did not satisfy. There's a staircase in Rome where Jesus is said to have gone up the steps to his crucifixion. And those stair steps have been brought to Rome. And visitors there who are seeking forgiveness will climb up those steps on their knees and pray on each step for forgiveness. And those steps are supposed to give special meaning to their prayers. I saw that stairway when I was in Rome many, many years ago. And he attempted that, but it did not bring him satisfaction. It just was not sufficient for him to be certain that he was forgiven. But he had found a Bible, which was hidden from the ordinary people, but being a monk, and he went into the library and found a Bible in Latin, and he was very familiar with the language, and so he read it with a great deal of interest. And one of the things that just kept in his mind was Romans, the first chapter, verses 16 and 17. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. And that just kept on coming back to him. It's faith. It's faith. It's not the works that have been prescribed by the church. It's faith. And it was about this time that John Tetzel came selling indulgences. And we'll look at that before we go on with the life of Luther. And I want us to think about this chart that we showed you the other day. This is has to do with the sacraments, or sacramentals as they call it. And here are seven different works through which grace enters into the life of an individual. The treasury of grace was established by the death of Christ, but the church possesses the keys to this treasury, and they can administer this grace according to their decisions. And these are the seven channels through which grace comes. Getting married, being ordained into one of the sacred holy orders. Then when you come to die, extreme unction and penance, which we'll discuss a little more in just a moment, and the Eucharist, that is the Mass, or we would call it the Lord's Supper, though they had turned it into a sacrifice, and confirmation. After an infant has been baptized, he must be confirmed by his own choice. And then baptism for the infant. And through all of these, grace comes from the church, or through the church, from the cross of Christ. But these are works through which grace comes. And it's a matter of salvation then by works. And it's against this that Luther became opposed. Penance is something that gave rise to the idea of indulgence. Because sin against God or one's neighbor, it's an individual or an individual who has sinned was required to make satisfaction for the offense. We're familiar, and we believe, the idea that a person who sins suffers two different consequences. On one hand, there is the consequence of guilt that must be forgiven by God, but there are other consequences that often attend it. Through sin, many times people contract some kind of disease, or they may lose all their money. There are consequences of that nature that follow sin. Now, the idea the church had was that God would forgive sin, but the church had required temporal punishment. If a person had sinned and there was no immediate consequence to be suffered in this life, then the church would have to prescribe some suffering for him. And the priest determined how much punishment he needed, how much would be required. And if a person didn't suffer enough in this life, and as a rule they didn't, they had to spend time in purgatory to finish out the full atonement, or the full satisfaction for their sin. And indulgence then, they claimed, was an act of mercy that was described by the church, or prescribed by the church, that reduced the penalty. So that instead of having to stay 500 years in purgatory, you might stay only 200 years or 100 years in purgatory. And living persons could buy indulgences for the dead. Just for example, if you have a dead father, and he was a pretty bad person, and he was forgiven by God, of venial sins, they made a difference between venial and mortal sins. If he was guilty of a lot of venial sins, he would have to spend a long time in purgatory. But if you would pay the church, give to the church, or do some other kind of good deed, you could get your father out of purgatory quicker. The saints would pray for him, and he'd get out of purgatory quicker. And you can just imagine that people with money who really love their parents or love their companion, their wife or brother or sister, would freely spend money to get them out of their suffering, to get them out of purgatory. And a little bit later, they developed the idea that you could even pay to get out of purgatory yourself a little bit earlier. And so that was especially attractive. John Tetzel was chosen to go through Germany selling these indulgences to raise money to build St. Peter's Cathedral. And he was being quite successful in getting a considerable amount of money for indulgences to sin even before the sin was committed. And in addition to that, of course, the privilege of having your loved ones removed from purgatory sooner. Well, Martin Luther and others were just absolutely horrified. at such claims. And so Luther nailed a list of 95 theses for debate regarding these indulgences to the church door in Wittenberg, or Wittenberg, it would be the German pronunciation, I guess, on October the 31st, 1517. He said, I'll debate anybody that will debate with me about this subject. His debate developed with John Eck, and in order to prove that the indulgences were not valid, he had to go to the scriptures, because the church had approved it. And if you accepted the authority of the church, then it was okay. But he went to the scriptures, and this forced him to determine that all authority was in scripture, not in the church. And so one of the first principles of Reformation was sola scriptura, which is Latin for the scriptures alone. And there were four others of these we may note just a little bit later. He was excommunicated by the Pope in what was called a papal bull, or bulletin, I guess is the idea. But he took his students into a public place, and with considerable publicity, he burned the excommunication decree from the Pope, indicating that he didn't care about it. At least he didn't respect it. He considered himself in a relationship with the Lord that was not based on his relationship with the Pope. There were several Renaissance developments that aided his cause. We've mentioned some of them. One of them was nationalism. The political leaders in that part of Germany were very disturbed because so much money was going out of their areas into the Catholic Church in Rome. And in addition to that was the study of Greek and Latin, which had been discouraged during the time of the Dark Ages, but now was encouraged by all students. And it was in Greek that, or Latin, that he found the scriptures. And soon after this, the scriptures were put into Greek by even one of his associates. The printing press was developed about this time, which made it possible for his tracts and writings to be spread throughout that part of Germany. And then there was individualism, indicating that each individual can establish a relationship with God directly rather than through the church. F.W. Maddox has made a couple of observations that I think are valuable. Luther had not desired separation from the Catholic Church, but his principles later forced him to a complete break. He was making progress toward a full understanding of New Testament truth until 1529, when he was forced to write his first creed. He was forced then to spend the rest of his life defending what he had written. And so he spent more time trying to defend what he had written than trying to see how much farther he needed to go in order to have the New Testament church as it was originally intended. At this same time, living at the same time, there was Ulrich Zwingli in Switzerland. He studied Greek and Hebrew and studied the scriptures in the original language. And when he began preaching in Zurich, he was changed the whole approach to preaching, because he began preaching through the scriptures. He did a series of sermons on the book of Matthew and then followed it by preaching from the rest of the books of the New Testament until he had preached through all of them. And this was something totally new, and the people were greatly impressed by this expository preaching. He was influenced by Luther, but he published his own 67 theses for debate. And interestingly enough, when he had his debate, he appointed the city council of Zurich to be the judges. And they judged that he had won that debate, and so they eventually made him the dictator of the city. He became a political leader as well as a religious leader. He was different from Luther, particularly on the subject of the Lord's Supper. The Catholic view was transubstantiation, that the bread becomes the literal body of Jesus and the wine becomes the literal blood of Jesus. Well, Luther didn't say that exactly. He called it consubstantiation, but he came awfully close to it, and Zwingli maintained it was a memorial, teaching much the same thing we teach about the real nature of the Lord's Supper as a memorial rather than as a sacrifice. I had the opportunity, by the kindness of Steve Wallace, of having dinner one night at the castle where Luther and Zwingli had met for their discussion in Germany. There's another difference, and this is very significant, really. And this is a statement from Maddox. Luther would remove only what the Bible condemned, but Zwingli would approve only what he found set forth in Scripture. Two different attitudes that account for two different approaches in the practices of the church. For example, and Wikipedia, this is a statement from Wikipedia. He eliminated instrumental music from worship in the church, stating that God had not commanded it in worship. And if it wasn't commanded, he didn't think it should be practiced. Now, Luther retained instrumental music because there was nothing that condemned it. Zwingli said, where is it commanded? Where is it authorized? Jerry Earnhardt, Paul's brother, preached in Zurich for many years, and he said that it was only after the Second World War that some of the churches in Zurich got their instrument back after it had been destroyed by the followers of Zwingli, which is an interesting thing. Actually, he was killed in a religious war. I mentioned that he became something of the dictator in Zurich, and he organized his followers there to try to get the country churches to depart from the Pope and to be united with the city churches. And eventually he tried to make peace, but eventually there was war between the country churches and the churches in Zurich. And in the war, he was killed. He was serving as a chaplain, I understand. But he was killed in a religious war, which is such a sad thing. His legacy lives on in the basic confessions of the Reformed churches of today. Though Calvin, which we're going to look at, did a lot more to influence the Reformed churches than Zwingli did. He accepted the idea, though, of councils and creeds, which was the downfall of many of these men who were reformers. They didn't get all the way back because the New Testament church did not have councils and creeds made by men. I've mentioned John Calvin. He was actually trained and educated in France, but on an appeal of one of the preachers from Geneva, he moved to Geneva, Switzerland, and there carried on in some degree the work that had been done by Zwingli. But he carried the thing farther and formed the doctrine of Calvinism, which is the basis now for the theology of nearly all of the so-called Reformed churches. I might mention that what we know as Reformed churches are generally the Presbyterian churches. A Reformed Wikipedia, one website, says Reformed theology is a body of doctrine that is taught by many different churches, including Presbyterian and some Baptist churches. In fact, looking at the internet, I saw very strong claim to being Calvinistic Baptist churches, Reformed Baptist Church in Lawrenceville, I believe. This body of doctrine reflects the teaching of the Protestant reformers of Zwingli and Calvin, and is also referred to as Calvinism. I'm not sure there's any evidence that Zwingli was Calvinistic in all of these points. He may have been in some of them, but I've not seen any evidence of that. Somebody might have some information on that. Calvin was educated in France, but moved to Geneva to build on the work of Zwingli. But as we've said, he added Calvinism. And we're familiar with the pillars of Calvinism: a total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and the persistence of the saved. And if you take the first letter of each of those, it comes out T-U-L-I-P, and is generally spoken of as the tulip doctrine of Calvinism. There was a preacher, a prominent preacher and teacher in the Netherlands by the name of Jacob Arminius, who opposed Calvinism. And sometime you're going to be called, perhaps, if you get into discussion with somebody who considers himself scholarly, you're going to be called an Arminian. And what that means is you don't accept Calvinism. I'm just a Christian myself, and Christianity doesn't accept Calvinism either. But that's what is meant when you're called an Arminian. Actually, Calvin was made the dictator of Geneva. He had so much influence that they gave him civil authority, and he used the civil government to execute 57 heretics, put them to death, and ban 67 from the city of Geneva. And what we're going to see is, as we go along, that the Catholic Church persecuted heretics, as they call them, and killed far more people than were killed by the Roman Empire. We talk about the persecution under the Roman Empire, but under the Roman Church was even greater. And as we see here, even those who called themselves reformers or were part of the Reformation also punished and persecuted those who disagreed with them, even by physical torture. These and others originally intended only to reform the Roman Church. They couldn't get away from the thought that it was the original church, but they saw the weaknesses in the practice and doctrine of the church, and so they thought they could reform it. But this failed. The church was not to be reformed. And when it did fail, they were excommunicated. And so, since they could not reform the Roman Catholic Church, their hope was to return to simple New Testament Christianity. And I think they studied the scriptures with that in mind. However, and I think this is something significant, they had adopted the Roman Catholic idea that the New Testament church was a confederation of local churches with councils and creeds. And so each one of them allowed his teaching. Well, they didn't necessarily intend it. Luther said he hoped no one would ever call himself a Lutheran. And he had no intention of starting a Lutheran church. But that's what happened, and it was the outgrowth of the fact that he believed that there could be councils that would represent the churches over which he had influence, and that creeds could be written which would establish the doctrines of that association of churches. And what he established then was the denomination, not the original church at all. And this concept that the church of the Lord is a confederation of local churches continues to hinder the complete duplication of New Testament churches in our time. There's a tendency to think of the Church of Christ, the one true church, as being all of those churches of Christ that follow the New Testament teaching. The New Testament church, the one true church, of which we read in the scriptures is not made up of congregations. It's made up of individuals. Every individual who is saved is added to that church. And in any local church, there are some, doubtless, who are truly in the church, but there are many who are not, because they are not personally established that relationship with Jesus Christ. But I want to go back to this chart that you've seen before, and I want you to remember little groups of Christians who didn't go along with all of this. They did not go along with the Roman Catholic Church and its hierarchy, and they did not join themselves to one of these denominations formed with councils and creeds. They simply stood independent of any worldly headquarters or hierarchy and followed the New Testament. We can't always trace the existence of such groups, but there seems to be some evidence that there were such groups in all time, but it doesn't matter whether they were or not. The kingdom is in the seed, and as long as the seed, the New Testament, exists, there will be the church of the Lord in the seed, if not planted in that particular generation. Well, I've talked and talked and talked too much, but it was necessary almost to do so in order to cover this much information. And I've asked the host to let me impose on them by taking another night of classes, because I'd like for us to get something of the background of the popular denominations. I think that's something that is important and good for us to know. And I've listed about 7 or 8 of them. And I would be glad for some of you who will be on the, who will be available next Monday night, to volunteer to spend 2 or 3 minutes describing the beginning of some of those denominations. I've already gotten a volunteer to describe the Methodist Church, and I'd be glad to have somebody to talk about the Church of England, which is a rather interesting development. The Church of England and the Presbyterian churches, which we've mentioned the root of them tonight, and the Baptist churches and other religious groups such as that, Nazarenes, Pentecostals, Jehovah's Witnesses. Be glad to have someone volunteer, but let me know before tomorrow night, because if I don't hear from you, I may volunteer you, as some old teachers used to say. Is there a question or a comment somebody would like to make? I'd like very much to hear from anyone. Anybody? Is anybody still there?
So,
hey, Joe.
It's Joe, yeah. Hey, before you, I don't want to interrupt if anybody has a comment or questions about your class. I had a question if you remember something from Nigeria, but I can ask that before you close out.
Okay. Let's appreciate that. We'll get back to you in a moment on that. Anybody have another question or comment on the class?
Hi, Brigham here.
Yes.
I was listening to Catholic radio the other day while I was driving in my car. Really don't know why. But anyway, they were talking about Lent and not eating fish on Fridays, something to that effect. And I was a little bit surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Is that again? I wasn't sure if somebody else said something. I was a little bit surprised to hear the word penitential, that there was something supposedly penitential about that, not eating meat and, I don't know, maybe giving up other things during Lent, some other practices. Does that fit into what you were saying before about just the idea of the church imposing temporal consequences for sin?
Yes, that's a form of penance. For many years, the Catholics would not eat meat on Friday, but fish was permitted. It didn't come under the ban, but meat on Friday was not to be eaten. And you got a certain amount of grace credit for that. And so many of those things, even reading the Bible after, for so many centuries, they forbade reading the Bible, but then they, under pressure, I think, from Protestants, they began encouraging the reading of the Bible. And if you notice in the front of a Catholic Bible, nearly always there's something to the effect that you get certain amount of grace from the eating of the Bible. So many points to help you get out of purgatory. But I think that's it. Now, they changed that idea of eating meat on Friday back, 40, 50 years ago. I remember when they changed it. But there's still Catholics that won't eat meat on Friday because they think there's something good about it. That's a good question.
Yeah, I used to work with one, and he would only eat fish on Friday.
Yeah. In fact, most restaurants, if they don't serve fish every day, they'll serve fish on Friday out of consideration. Some of them don't know why, I don't imagine, but it's out of consideration for their Catholics.
That's where
I vaguely remember one that, like, there was a Pope that had a connection with fishing, or there was something that it wasn't that it, you know, there was some politicking or whatever to have fish not banned on Friday. If I remember reading something correctly.
Your rebuttal to that? I remember I baptized a Catholic, young Catholic, in New Jersey. He was Italian, and he was always talking about his meatballs and how good they were. So we started trying to arrange for him to make us some meatballs. And I said, well, when can we get together? Could we get together Friday night? He said, how about Thursday? I said, well, can we see? I checked. I said, no, Thursday just won't work. And Saturday night, he said, what about Saturday? I said, no, we need to get ready to go to service on Sunday. Friday is just the best time. So he finally agreed to Friday. And then he was not going to eat with us at all. And I couldn't figure that out. Finally insisted. We insisted he eat with us. And when he brought out his spaghetti and had a meatball, and when he finished eating, that meatball was still on his plate.
Yeah.
And I thought about that in connection with our study of Romans, of 1 Corinthians, the ninth chapter, eighth and ninth chapter, that I felt bad about pushing him to do that. It's just all his life. He had been told he should not eat meat on Friday. And even though he had learned better than that, and I think would have argued the case, he still just couldn't do it. And I felt really bad that I'd pushed him to do something that was really contrary to his conscience. And I appreciated him for not doing what he had doubts about.
Although I learned to eat fish and spaghetti and pasta, whatever, up in New York.
Okay.
I never heard of doing such a thing. It had to be hamburger meat till I sojourned up there.
All right. Anybody else?
Oh, one thing that I've read that I've found interesting is that a lot of this the interest in reading the Bible in the original languages was stirred up because of the fall of Constantinople. And so many people that had that kind of knowledge of Greek and fleeing from that, heading westward and starting to fill the universities and being able to offer that kind of teaching. And just another interesting example how persecution and unrest can bring about good consequences.
Yes, the approach of the Muslims to Constantinople caused them to flee. And they brought with them those studies of Greek. That's correct.
So really, what even you didn't mention, but Erasmus and doing the translations and all, was critical to Wycliffe, you know, yes. Wycliffe using Erasmus's translations.
Yes. Erasmus put it into Greek. Wycliffe into English. That's the interesting thing, yeah. Okay, anything else?
Just, I guess, in reading that, I mean, you know, in England, when they were doing, got the Bibles in English, they had to, they chained the Bibles to the podium because people were coming there and reading it, whatever, just to keep them from taking it away.
And Wycliffe made it rather common for people to have them. But then they burned them. Tyndale is one of the most interesting characters. I don't know if we'll find time to talk much about him, but he's one of the interesting characters of the Reformation.
But then it's like 80% of the King James is Wycliffe, some number like that.
Yeah. Okay. If there's nothing else, Joe, we'll get back to you. What do you got in mind about Nigeria?
Well, you know, we lost my brother last week. You know that.
I'm so sorry.
Mark. Yeah. Do you remember Sewell Mark was about 7 years old, and I think it was a dad called you across the field. Mark had malaria, and he was laying on the floor going into convulsions. And you and Dad were standing there in, I think it was a bathroom over there where the Knicks and the Finneys live. And you came over and you looked down, you said, James, let's pray. I remember that like it was yesterday.
Well, your dad mentioned that, and it was a time to pray, and we were thankful Mark came through. But sorry, it's passed on now.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Terry learned to read along with Mark. They were in private school that was furnished that they did. The mother, of course, was the teacher in out the rural bush, Nigeria. And Mark was a little older than Terry, and Terry went to class with Mark. And as he learned to read, she learned to read also before she was six.
Is that amazing?
Hey, everybody. No.
Hey, Sewell.
Would you like to?
Yes.
I'll do Jehovah's Witness for you next week.
Okay. That'll be fine, Joe. Be glad to have it. We'll need to keep it down to a couple of 3 minutes about the bowls so we can get them.
About 3 minutes. I'll make it quick. And good, we're with a lady tonight that we taught about 3 years ago who was a Catholic. And she obeyed the gospel then, and we're sitting with her because she got out of surgery. Jan and I are over here with her.
Well,
but she's been listening and commenting when you talked about the Catholics, and she'll say, "Yeah, that's right," you know.
Yeah.
So,
well, there's some very fine people among the Catholics. I want to stress that, very conscientious people, and nothing said against the Catholic Church is intended to question their sincerity, but they're just mistakes have made through the years, and we need to be sure we avoid them.
Yeah.
Okay, I appreciate that, Joe. Thank you.
Yep.
And does anybody else want to volunteer while we're on?
Oh, this is Nate. I'd like to do the Church of England, if that's okay. You want 3 minutes on them?
That'd be great. Thank you. Yeah.
So does Nate get 3 minutes for the Church of England and 3 minutes for the Episcopalians?
Mm-hmm. You can take care of the Episcopalian pretty quick after you get the church. All right, very good. Well, thanks so much for your participation. We're a little over an hour now, and appreciate again the Poles hosting this, and pray that God will bless the efforts that we've made to understand the past a little bit better so that we can deal with problems in the present. With a little bit more knowledge. Thank you and good night.